going to talk about the humane economy this hour. We'll find out what that is and why it's growing. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the CEO and president of the Humane Society of the United States. And he is the author of The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. And we'll find out why it's good business to be good to animals as well. We'll welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Wayne Pacelli is CEO and president of the Humane Society of the United States. He is the author of The Humane Economy. And we last spoke to Wayne Pacelli in March of 2015, so more than a year ago. We talked about, at that time, the Ringling Brothers' announcement that they would stop using elephants in their traveling shows by 2018. And Wayne, they just announced this month that they're ending those elephants sooner than they thought.
Well, good morning to you, Joy. So glad to be back with you. Yes, it was a seismic announcement within the animal welfare community, at least, when Ringling in March 2015 said it would end its traveling elephant acts. And of course, elephants are at the center of the brand of Ringling Brothers, so for that company at least, it was no small matter. And it said it would phase them out over a couple of years, but it accelerated that, and I think that is a good indicator of how fast things are moving on animal protection issues in our society.
Yeah, so why is this an example of the humane economy?
Well, my thesis in the book is that companies that have animal cruelty baked into the business model are going to be facing risk, and they're going to be facing protests, and they're facing lawsuits and public policy and regulatory reform actions, and they're just going to generally curry the disfavor of the public. And Ringling, I think, is a great example of that. You know, for 145 years, they were carting elephants around the country in traveling acts, and essentially what happens at Ringling is they do three nights in Milwaukee, and they do three nights in Minneapolis, and three nights in Bismarck, and they're going all around the country for 350 days a year. And elephants were chained up for 22 hours a day, so they could barely take a step forward or a step back. They were carted between cities on railroad cars. The only time they got off the chains is for the couple of hours that they were at the performance. They would walk to the arena for the performance, and then they would walk back. And, of course, they did these silly stunts where elephants would stand on their heads or they would, you know, turn around at a rapid pace. These are not really normal behaviors. I mean, in some very, very rare circumstance, they might engage in those behaviors. But they did so on request because of fear that the handlers have bull hooks in their hands, which is like a fire poker with a sharp point, a sharp metal point at the end, and they would strike the animals and induce fear, and it's because of that fear that they would perform on cue. And I think, to answer your question, so many people began to learn the backstory. They saw undercover footage of what really happens. We began to learn about the incredible intelligence of elephants, the fact that they grieve for their young. They stay in these family groups for decades. They have a full range of emotions and feelings. Many people said, well, you know, if we can entertain ourselves, if we can have Cirque du Soleil and we can have other circus performances that don't use wild animals in acts, then maybe we can do that. And I think Ringling saw the polling. It had hired pollsters to take, you know, stock of where the American public is. And I think they saw all sorts of red flags, especially among millennials.
Yeah. And just recently, too, we heard from SeaWorld that it is going to stop its breeding programs for the killer whale. And that was something that's yet another example of the humane economy.
Yes, I entered into discussions starting last June 2015, with the CEO of SeaWorld. He had been new to his job. He came in of April last year. And SeaWorld had been buffeted by a documentary called Blackfish. It had been done by Gabriella Comprethwaite. It had a very strong theatrical release, but then CNN bought the rights to Blackfish and just began to run it over and over again, and it got incredible ratings. Again, another indicator that it struck a chord with the American public. I know, Joy, that my niece and nephew, without any prompting from me, watched Blackfish on CNN. They called me and said, Uncle Wayne, what can you do about this? And I think they probably had a similar reaction to so many other millions of young people and older people around the country, and SeaWorld needed to change. I mean, it was an enormous risk to continue the status quo, and SeaWorld committed with the Humane Society of the United States to end its orca breeding program and the theatrical shows, to spend millions more on rescue and rehabilitation of stranded marine mammals, to join us in our anti-commercial whaling, anti-shark finning, and anti-commercial sealing efforts. And they also agreed to change their food policies at their parks, where they're going to source more humanely raised products and more plant-based options at their restaurants and food service operations. So, Joy, if you take both together, the Ringling announcement and the SeaWorld announcement, again, the two biggest brands in the use of live animals in entertainment, and major changes, that signals a big change in society.
Yeah, and in fact, SeaWorld just announced last week that orcas will no longer do things like dance or kiss or, you know, do things like that in their theatrical shows. What's wrong with that, Wayne?
Well, I would say that, again, it really speaks to kind of the dignity of these animals, and should the world's biggest, most powerful, most intelligent animals be forced to do stunts and tricks to entertain us? You know, in my book, I go back to a century ago, and I talk about the Bronx Zoo, and I note that they had a pygmy from Southern Africa on display at the Bronx Zoo to make some attenuated point about other cultures. I mean, this man was incarcerated basically at the zoo. The world is changing. You know, that would of course not last a day today, and people would obviously not be permitted to do that sort of thing. And I think our standards and our tastes are changing. And the idea of having elephants perform stunts or orcas perform stunts is just not where the public is at this point. These companies are starting to get it, and they're making adjustments in their business model.
And there's many, many other examples that we'll talk about as we go along. But talk some about just how big is the public's role in the humane economy?
I think it's fundamental. I mean, I argue in the humane economy that there's an ensemble cast of characters who are contributing to the changes in belief and attitude that we're all seeing. I mean, scientists are teaching us about animals. Undercover investigators are giving us the backstory. Advocacy groups like the Humane Society of the United States are pushing for reform. There are so many different players, documentarians like, you know, Gabriella Comprethwaite, who did Blackfish, or Robert Kenner, who did Food, Inc. Obviously, you know, public radio and television and all of the other news outlets, the presence of social media and the ability of information to ricochet overnight. I mean, all of this is adding up to a much more informed electorate and a much more informed consumer base. And I think that is what is changing everything.
So this is changing everything, and big businesses and institutions like the circus and SeaWorld are changing. They are at risk if they continue to use or abuse animals in certain ways. But why is it good business to be good to animals?
Well, I think it really eliminates a whole set of problems for you, so you don't have nearly as much in the way of litigation costs. You don't have to fight a public relations battle and have operatives that are kind of 24/7. I mean, all of these costs that you must then bear in order to defend your brand, you really don't have to. But I think more than that, even if you lose 15 or 20% of your people, that may not sound like a lot. That may be the difference between failure and success for a company. And I also think that 10 or 15% of the people who are agitated can really just be an immense nuisance. And then I think you expand, you know, your base of supporters when you then have this halo effect. And when people realize that, yes, this business is about making money, but it's also kind of aligning its conduct and its operations with our values. You know, think of the issue of Cecil, the lion,
and the
killing last year of that lion in Zimbabwe, lured out of a national park by a guy in Minnesota, Walter Palmer, and his professional guide whom he hired. Overnight, we saw the image of this grinning man with his grinning guide over this beautiful slain lion. And it outraged people because it was not a hunt for meat. It was not a hunt for management. And in fact, it was an animal who had been radio collared. It was an animal who had been the subject of lots of profiles. People knew about this particular lion. They came to Hwange National Park specifically to see this lion. And, you know, within 3 to 4 weeks, we had talked to dozens of airlines, and 45 airlines said, we are not going to carry trophies in the cargo hold from African lions, elephants, rhinos, leopards, or Cape buffalo. Those five species constitute the Africa Big Five. That's an award given out by trophy hunting groups to individual members who kill each of those five species. I mean, the airlines in some ways were just kind of a backdrop for the larger debate in society. And we saw that a small number of people are interested in trophy hunting. A much larger universe of people are interested in wildlife watching. So many African countries, for instance, like Botswana and Kenya, have been changing their policies. And this goes to your question, Joy, about why it's good business. If Botswana is open to people coming to shoot elephants and lions, that's going to turn off an enormous number of potential visitors to Botswana. But if Botswana says, listen, we are forthrightly going to say we're throwing, you know, our management policies in alignment with animal protection values. We want you to come with a camera. We want you to go on safari. We want you to have the experience of a lifetime, but you're going to leave the animals there. You're going to keep them alive. That is a marketing opportunity for Botswana, because if you're in a competitive circumstance with Tanzania and Kenya and Mozambique, and you say, listen, we're the country that is going to give you this incredible, rich wildlife experience, but we're not going to allow any of these animals to be shot for trophies. That's a marketing advantage, and I think that, in sum, is one indicator of how the humane economy is working.
We are talking about the humane economy with Wayne Pacelli, who is the author of The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Wayne is also CEO and president of the Humane Society of the United States. We welcome your questions for him, and maybe even your own examples of ways we have changed when it comes to the treatment of animals. When we come back, we'll talk about decisions of companies like McDonald's and Walmart only accepting eggs from cage-free chickens. We'll talk some about pet stores and puppy mills, too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. So what problems do you see with how we treat animals? What positive changes have you seen in recent years? What changes do you hope to continue to see in the treatment of animals in coming years? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with Wayne Pacelli. He is the author of The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. And we are welcoming your questions and your input. I wanted to talk with you a little bit next, Wayne, about pet stores and puppy mills. You mentioned in the book that if asked years ago where to get a dog, you would not have suggested going to a pet store. Why is that?
Well, because pet stores have been a primary sales channel for puppies raised typically in the Midwest in large commercial breeding operations that we refer to and that are popularly referred to as puppy mills, where the breeding females are typically subjected to breeding every heat cycle. They're kept in cages. Sometimes they're stacked outside. The animals are exposed to extremes of heat and cold. They're kept, you know, outside year-round. They're denied veterinary care. And when they're done with them, you know, they're typically killed or they're sold at auction. I mean, this is essentially an agricultural mindset applied to dog production. And these puppy mills are ones that we've investigated and exposed all over the country. We rescue thousands of dogs from mills every year where things get so bad that it's violative of the anti-cruelty statutes in the states, and that then we're warranted to come in with law enforcement to rescue the animals. So it's a big problem, but again, part of the problem with animal cruelty in our society is that the public has a hard time seeing it and finding it because they don't know the backstory. So you get a little puppy in a glass enclosure at a pet store, and you really don't know whether that animal's parents were well-treated or not. We have really traced from the pet store back to the breeding facility what really happens. People can go to our website, humanesociety.org, to learn about some of those grim details. But pet stores have been those channels. So I, as a person who loves dogs, never wanted to patronize one of those operations. But the change has happened in the last 20 years when PetSmart and Petco threw open their doors to rescue groups and shelters to make adoptable dogs available on their floors. And I got my Lily, a beagle mix, who was just about to be euthanized at a rural Virginia shelter, and a local rescue group pulled her just in the nick of time. And they worked through PetSmart to adopt her out. And my wife and I went to that PetSmart that day looking for a dog. Obviously, I have a lot of sources as president of the Humane Society. But I got Lily there. And to me, it was a great indicator of the changing business practices that benefit animals. PetSmart and Petco, you know, didn't do that previously in the 90s. But they switched that model in the mid-90s. And since that time, they've helped adopt out 11 million dogs and cats, which is a very big number and takes a big bite out of the euthanasia problem in the United States.
Yeah. I adopted my cat, my orange and white tabby cat, Ray, from PetSmart, too. And
good for you,
Joy. He's really a character. You have a cat, Zoe, too.
I do. She was, you know, many cats come to us. They find us. We don't find them. I was walking Lily one morning, and Zoe was trailing behind me. She had been dumped by somebody. She was a really well-socialized cat, so I don't know what happened, but somebody almost certainly dumped her because we put flyers out everywhere for a lost cat to reconnect her. But that's how she came to me, and pets enrich our lives in so many ways, yet it's amazing in our society that we spend $2 billion a year on sheltering homeless animals and running the operations of animal shelters, and we still have these mills churning out 2 to 4 million dogs a year. The number of animals euthanized in our shelters is about 2.5 million. We could solve the problem of animal euthanasia if people made the adoption choice more frequently, if they decided, okay, when I acquire an animal, I'm going to go to a shelter or a rescue group or a place that provides a channel for adopting them out. And if we could just dry up this market for puppy mills, which cause, you know, really complicates the adoption pipeline, but also has enormous, enormous responsibility for the mistreatment of so many dogs in our country.
Yeah. Other innovations within the pet adoption movement include that you mentioned in the book, Petfinder. How is that a part of the humane economy?
Well, you know, shelters and rescue groups are really competing against the pet stores these days, and the pet stores are doing their best to provide a range of products, if you will, different types of dogs that are appealing to consumers. And when you went to a shelter historically, they may have a limited supply of certain kinds of dogs that you want, and they may have many more types of a particular breed or a couple of breeds that you don't want. So what Petfinder did is it allowed shelters and rescue groups, all of them, to post their animals on a website, petfinder.com, so you could get a picture and a biography of all of the animals in the community or the state or even nationwide. And you can find any kind of animal that you want. If you want a Portuguese water dog, if you want a Bichon, if you want a Maltese, any kind of dog you want, you can get through Petfinder because it aggregates the supply, if you will, just speaking in supply and demand terms, of animals out there, and it is much broader than a single shelter or a single rescue group. And there have been about 24 million dogs and cats adopted with the use of that web tool these days, and that, too, has been an incredible innovation. It's allowed shelters and rescues to be more competitive with the traditional channels of selling puppy mill dogs.
Our guest is Wayne Pacelli. He is the author of The Humane Economy. He is also the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. And we are talking about the changes that we are seeing in animal welfare and how it is good business to be good to animals. And if you're not good to animals, how that can be bad business. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming maybe your own examples. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will talk agriculture now. And let me bring in a caller who's been waiting, Matt in Menominee Falls. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Great program, and thanks for all that you're doing there, Wayne. I appreciate that. My question might be a little bit different, but I think it's still on topic. In regards to factory farms and some of the treatment that, you know, whether it's cows or pigs or chickens, but I wonder if you can comment on some of the factory farms and the way those animals are treated.
Well, and thank you very much, Matt, for calling. I did want to get into this. And Wayne, first maybe you can talk a little bit about how public pledges from companies like McDonald's and Walmart regarding cage-free eggs spurred changes in animal agriculture.
Well, it's been a long process, Joy. We have been campaigning at the Humane Society of the U.S. for many years. We actually did a number of ballot measures and undercover investigations to expose what we call the extreme confinement of certain animals on large industrial farms or factory farms. And the three most exploitative practices are the confinement of veal calves in generally 22-inch wide crates where the calves literally can't turn around at all. They're side to side. They're confined in this crate, and they're typically tethered as well. The other practice for mammals is the confinement of breeding sows in the pig industry in what's called a gestation crate. This is a 300 or 400 or 500 pound sow, and she is confined in a 2-foot by 7-foot cage for about 3 years. I mean, she is impregnated over and over again. Pigs have a 4-month gestation period, so she's in that crate for 4 months, and then just before she gives birth, she's put in another crate that's about the same size to give birth, and then she's immediately reimpregnated and then put back into the gestation crate. So she can't turn around either. The third practice relates to birds, and it's the treatment of laying hens to produce eggs. And the conventional system that developed over the last 50 or 60 years is called the battery cage. And it's a small wire cage about the size of a large bread box or microwave, and 6 or 8 birds are jammed in there alive, shoulder to shoulder, so they can barely flap their wings at all. And they, under the industry standard, a voluntary standard, which about 20% of producers don't even meet, the hens have about 67 square inches of space. So if you take an average 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, your standard copy paper, letter-sized paper, that's 93 square inches. So to get to 67, you'd have to cut 1/3 of it off, and that's the space that the hen has for the 12 to 18 months that she's alive. I mean, they're jammed into these cages to the point where they're immobilized. I went to one farm in northern Iowa, not too far from the Wisconsin border, and there were 10 million birds at one complex. There were 150,000 birds per building. There were 93 buildings, and they were stacked side to side as long as a football field, and they were stacked eight high. I mean, it was just madness to see this concentration of animals confined so severely they could barely move, and that has become acceptable and the norm in animal agriculture in the United States. And, you know, I shook my head, and my colleagues and so many others shook their head and say, you know, we can do better than this as a society, that animals conscripted to provide food for humans, the least we can do to pay them back is to treat them decently, to give them a humane life. And we've been pushing on this for years, and really in the last 4 years or so, we've broken through in a big way. The first thing we did is we got a commitment from the veal industry to phase out all confinement crates by 2017. The next thing that happened is McDonald's said in January 2012, that it's going to phase out its purchase of pork from operations that confine the sows in these crates. After that, we got dozens of other companies, all the big names in food retail, to make a similar pledge. Now, in the last 8 months, we've gotten more companies than committed on the pigs to commit to going cage-free, to make all of their purchases over time from suppliers that don't confine the hens in cages at all. Again, McDonald's started the cascade in September of 2015, and then in April of 2016, just last month, Walmart, the biggest retailer in the world and by far the biggest food seller in the United States, which sells about 15 billion eggs a year, has agreed to phase out over a decade's time the confinement of hens in its supply chain. So it's not overnight. It's not immediate. We hope, like Ringling accelerated its time frame to get the elephants out of traveling acts, Walmart and McDonald's and others are able to make these pledges real on a shorter time frame. But we're very excited that just about every big food retailer in the United States has said animal welfare matters, that cage confinement or crate confinement of animals is unacceptable, and they're going to align their practices with the beliefs of consumers who think these practices are unacceptable.
All right, so that battle is won. No more work with factory farms?
Well, that is one metric. Cage confinement or crate confinement we judge to be the most severe problem. We'd also been working on tail docking of dairy cows, and of course Wisconsin is the first or second biggest dairy-producing state, depending upon if you're looking at the number of cows in production or the amount of milk produced or the number of farms. And one of the customary practices for years was to literally cut the tail off of the cow. This is living tissue for the animal. We're not talking about the hair at the end of the tail. Now, we have gotten a pledge from the National Milk Producers Federation, which is a trade association for the dairy industry, to end tail docking by 2017. It's a voluntary standard, so we hope that all producers are going to adhere to it. But this is an archaic practice. Even the American Veterinary Medical Association and even the vets within the dairy industry, the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, have said that this is an unnecessary and inhumane practice and should end. So we're hoping to have that aspect of factory farming curtailed as well. There are a lot of other issues with factory farming. There is fast growth of animals. Chickens raised for meat, which is a different type of bird than the birds raised for egg production, grow so fast that if you and I and other people grew this fast, by the age of 2 years of age, in infancy, we would weigh nearly 400 pounds. Mm-hmm. These animals have been selectively bred for enormous fast growth, and it creates a number of chronic health problems. Some of these animals have heart attacks at very young age. They're unable to walk. So from a physiological perspective, they have all sorts of health ailments that are chronic and endemic to this sort of breeding practice. And that's a continuing concern. So, you know, my book talks about a number of different factory farming practices. And frankly, it also talks about people eating more plant-based foods because we're raising far too many animals in our society for food. We raise 9 billion animals a year. That is more animals who are raised and slaughtered in the United States than there are people on the planet. I mean, just think about the logistical exercise of slaughtering 9 billion animals a year. It is way too much. We eat per capita more meat than any other people in the world, and that's part of the explanation for obesity and heart disease and a variety of cancers. It's an enormous contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and it contributes so much waste to the environment because of all of the methane and all of the other forms of waste that animals produce. It is also a big source of animal exploitation when animals are jammed into these warehouses and really have no kind of semblance of a normal behavioral life.
We have a number of small and large farms in Wisconsin, but one proposal, I wonder if we can get a quick reaction. I don't think you wrote about it in your book. Wisconsin may become the home of the largest goat farm or goat milking operation in the United States. The plan is to create an operation for 9,000 goats. And this is in part to address what is being called a goat milk shortage. I guess goat cheese is pretty popular these days. What's your reaction to this? And what do you think farmers should keep in mind about animal treatment as this progresses?
Well, I think, you know, that is not one of the primary means of agricultural production with animals in the U.S., but obviously that's a sizable operation. I mean, 9,000 goats is not small. It wouldn't be large, you know, looking at a pig farm at a factory level scale, or certainly not chickens. But, you know, obviously there are a lot of different metrics, animal welfare, science-oriented metrics to consider when thinking about the well-being of animals. And, you know, mobility is one, you know, the ability to move around, the ability to interact with others of your kind, you know, on a scale that's appropriate. You know, when you go into one of these broiler bird operations for meat production, I mean, there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of birds, you know, on the floor at once. Now, you know, hens flock together, but not at densities like that and not on a scale like that. I'm on the board of something called the Global Animal Partnership, which is a certification program for animals raised in agriculture. And Whole Foods Market, which is, you know, one of the big brand names in the world of food retail, now uses this 1 to 5 rating system for all of the animal products it sells. And 1 essentially means that the animals are not kept in cages or crates that immobilize them. 2, it means they're not subjected to routine mutilations like tail docking or ear cropping. 3 means they've got access to pasture. 4 is entirely pasture-based. 5 is slaughtered on the farm. Now, there are many different standards within each species group because they're all science-based standards. But that gives your listeners a little bit of a framework on what animal welfare means at higher and higher levels. So I believe we do have a goat production standard, and for the goat farmers who are involved in this new enterprise in Wisconsin, they should consult the GAP standards. And obviously, more and more consumers are going to be paying attention to these issues. And, you know, when you talk about milk production, there's been, you know, a big change in our society because not only do we have, you know, cow's milk, dairy cow's milk, and goat milk, but now we have almond milk, we have rice milk, we have soy milk, we have a number of other types of milk available. And this is giving consumers more choice in this domain.
We are talking with Wayne Pacelli. He is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, and he is also the author of the new book, The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. So talked about a number of different areas so far this hour, from factory farms to the circus to SeaWorld. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about animals in the wild, a little bit more about hunting. We'll talk about the wolf hunt in Wisconsin, among other things. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about animal welfare and the future treatment of animals and how our concern over the treatment of animals is changing business. Our guest says it's good business to be good to animals, and we are talking about how various protests and innovations and policy changes, how the public are impacting the lives of animals. Wayne Pacelli is our guest. He is the author of The Humane Economy. He's also CEO and president of the Humane Society of the United States. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org if you have a question or an example. Josh in Sparta is with us. Hi, Josh.
Good morning. Interesting conversation. And I'm just curious, I think it'd be difficult for Wayne not to agree that sportsmen, especially here in the United States, contribute more resources to wildlife than anyone else in the country, whether it's either organizations like the Boone and Crockett Organization, or Ducks Unlimited, or from just legislative proposals such as the Pittman-Robinson Act or the Dingell-Johnson Act. And, you know, sportsmen around the world are the ones that are actually creating habitat and producing funds to extend the wildlife industry.
So what do you
say? I actually just did a debate on this issue on a program called Intelligence Squared, so the listener can watch that. It was a two-on-two debate with two advocates of the sport hunting community and myself and one other advocate of animal welfare. And we actually contested that narrative, not to say that hunters don't pay license fees and that there aren't certain additional inputs that are offered into the wildlife management system, but we talked about how the vast, vast majority of public lands were acquired by means other than dollars from sportsmen. And we essentially argued that most of the money that comes from hunters goes for game management programs designed to essentially, you know, manage those activities and those operations, and very little goes to threatened and endangered species and non-game wildlife. So for those interested on an in-depth level, this was an hour-and-a-half debate where we really got into the nuts and bolts of this. Let me just say in a broader sense that the Humane Society of the U.S. is not working to abolish all hunting. We are very focused on stopping what we regard to be the most extreme, unsporting, biologically reckless forms of hunting. And that has led us, you know, squarely into criticisms of practices in Wisconsin like bear baiting and hound hunting of bears, where people put out food for black bears and then shoot the animals while they feed. This is unsporting. It's inhumane. It teaches bears bad behavior. Those bears that aren't shot become habituated to human food sources. You don't allow baiting for waterfowl. You don't allow baiting for a variety of species. Why should we allow it for bears? Big problems with hound hunting, where bears are chased by packs of dogs, with the dogs having radio transmitters on their collars. The hunters are engaging in a sort of war game with them where they're tracking the dogs on their handheld directional finder as the dogs are chasing the bear. Eventually, the dogs drive the bear up a tree, and then a hunter follows that signal to the tree and shoots the bear out of a tree. Again, unsporting, inhumane, and conscripting dogs into this enterprise of predator hunting. The other issue that's been of great concern to the Humane Society of the U.S. has been wolf hunting, commercial trapping, and trophy hunting of wolves. Now, just like nobody eats in the United States dogs, people don't eat wolves. Wolves are known to play a critical role in maintaining the health of ecosystems. Wherever wolves are, there has been no chronic wasting disease. This is a problem that's plaguing Wisconsin now, largely because Wisconsin has deer farms where trophy deer are being grown on these farms for shooting in what effectively amounts to a captive hunting or canned hunting situation. It's threatening the wild cervid populations, wild deer. Even though Wisconsin has an abundant deer population, there are plenty of opportunities for sportsmen to shoot deer, yet there are more than 400 of these deer farms that are now threatening to spread disease to the entire Wisconsin deer population. And tens of millions of dollars have been spent by the state DNR to try to curtail and contain the spread of the disease. So if we're thinking about conservation, deer farming doesn't contribute to it. if we're thinking about conservation, the idea of CWD incubating, which is it's a variant of mad cow disease that so many of us heard about when there have been outbreaks in the UK and then more limited outbreaks in the US. This is a very serious problem, and I think if we're going to talk about sportsmen being responsible, they should be joining us in condemning these deer farms, and I just don't see any argument for trophy hunting and commercial trapping of wolves since the animals are inedible.
Let me get your reaction to news in Wisconsin last week. Two Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin announced plans that they want to hold a regional wolf summit to discuss what one of the legislators, Senator Tom Tiffany, says is an out-of-control wolf population. Senator Tiffany said that we must return wolf management to the states, to Wisconsin. He cited a number of problems just in recent months of wolves, reportedly killing cattle and even pets, and saying that that we have to return wolf hunting, which was ceased or at least halted by a lawsuit, I believe, that the Humane Society was involved in, wasn't it, Wayne?
Yes, wolves had been listed in the Upper Great Lakes region on the federal endangered species list since the mid-1970s. There were a number of efforts by the federal government to delist wolves and throw management back to the states. It was done a few years ago. We had blocked the delisting efforts for a number of years. Wisconsin then did gain the right to open a hunt, killed an enormous number of wolves, about 20% of the population in a short span, eliminated 17 entire family groups, and then we were able to get back in court, win the case, make the argument convincingly to the federal government that wolf delisting was premature and the wolves had not properly recovered, and also that the states were not responsibly handling their responsibility. They were allowing too many wolves to be killed. And, you know, again, I want to underscore, wolves, you know, it's one thing, and the Humane Society is not objecting to this, a Wisconsin sportsman shooting a deer and eating the meat, himself or herself and the family eating the meat. You know, as a meat-eating society in general, if that is what people are going to do, you could argue that that is probably more humane than buying meat products from a factory farm. But no one is killing wolves for meat. It's purely a trophy-killing exercise or, at best, a fur sales opportunity for the commercial trappers involved.
What do you say, though, if they say the wolf hunters say, well, we're protecting livestock and pets?
Well, number one, I say that the hunt is designed not to eliminate the population, so either way, you're going to have some wolves around. And occasionally, wolves are going to bump into people and some of their enterprises, whether it's livestock operations or pet keeping. Obviously, you know, good responsible pet owners want to monitor their animals and keep tabs on them to the greatest extent possible. And in terms of livestock, yes, there's a very occasional kill of cattle or sheep by wolves, but there are compensation programs, and you know, we do lose animals occasionally to weather and to other natural factors. It is a tiny, tiny fraction of the number of animals lost. But I think the other point is there was just a study that came out that basically said wolf control programs conducted through sport hunting and commercial trapping do not reduce the frequency of livestock depredation because you change the profile of the populations. You disrupt the stable pack structures and you have more juveniles who then fan out after the alpha male and female have been killed. And you have more animals in the population less skilled at killing traditional prey, like deer or other cervids, and they may be more likely to then predate on livestock. So I think the science is showing us that these random killings of wolves that are not bothering anybody actually disrupt the social relationships in pack structures that cause animals to fan out, create a younger juvenile population that is more likely to be involved in depredation of animals.
Laura in Cobb is with us. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Wayne, it's my pleasure to have the opportunity to speak with you briefly. However, I have to call question because as a dairy farmer here in Wisconsin, I just constantly get the feeling that it will never be enough. The changes that we are already continuously making to do better for the lives of our animals, we just get the feeling that really the end game for you is a society where no animals are kept. And
because we're almost out of time, Laura, I'm glad you called. Is that the end game, Wayne? No animals being kept as pets or raised for meat or whatever?
No, not at all. We want people. I'm glad that the caller asked the question. It's an important one because I know it's on the mind of some farmers. You know, and one of the ways that we are really demonstrating that's not the case is we just formed a National Agricultural Advisory Council at HSUS. We have farmers, working farmers and ranchers who are members of the Humane Society who are saying, yes, we think it's fine and good and proper to raise animals for food, but we're going to raise them properly. So we take a pluralistic approach. If someone wants to be a vegetarian, we think that's great. If someone wants to eat animal products, that is great too. Just accept the idea that we've got to treat animals well. And that's the bottom line for us at the organization.
Yeah. So we just have a minute or so to go here. What can individuals do to contribute to the humane economy?
Well, at the end of my book, Joy, I have 10 ways that people can build the humane economy. One way, of course, is to vote with your dollars for animal protection. Don't buy cosmetics tested on animals. Make food choices that are respectful to animals. You know, shun buying fur. But also, we've got to be politically engaged. We've got to elect candidates to office who care about animals. We've got to advocate for policies to protect animals. Joining groups like the Humane Society of the United States, where you can have your voice, you know, kind of joined with the voices of thousands or millions of others to exert pressure in society for better outcomes for animals across different sectors of our economy.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Wayne Pacelli is the CEO and president of the Humane Society of the United States. He is also the author of The Humane Economy, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. Thanks to Brianne Shasso and Nyasia Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Coming up next, it's On Point, and On Point will be dealing with the Affordable Care Act. And tomorrow at this time, we will talk with the author of the book, Some Like It Cold, Surfing the Malibu of the Midwest. And yes, that's Lake Michigan, surfing on Lake Michigan. We'll talk about that as a cultural phenomenon coming up tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.